This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A few months ago, we aired a program about sexual assault on college campuses. That show came in response to a federal discrimination complaint against UConn, where student victims alleged that the university failed to protect their well-being. The university has denied the charges, calling some of them factually inaccurate. Then this week, a Wesleyan student filed suit against a campus fraternity, alleging negligent behavior that allowed her to be raped. Reports like these have raised concerns once again about student safety, prompting activists to push for legislation that would require schools to better manage issues of sexual attacks and violence. The topic even got the attention of the White House. Here's President Barack Obama in late January.
There's obviously more that we have to do to keep our students safe. And that's why here today, I will sign a presidential memorandum creating the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault. And we're going to work with colleges and universities and educational institutions of all kinds across America to help them come up with better ways to prevent and respond to sexual assault on their campuses. And then we'll help them put those ideas into practice. Because our schools need to be places where our young people feel secure and confident as they prepare to go as far as their God-given talents can carry them.
Today, Where We Live, we're revisiting campus sexual assault, joined by a panel of guests to talk about why these crimes persist on college campuses. We do want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. With your thoughts and your questions, you can always follow along at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live, and you can send us an email, wherewelive@WNPR.org. Joining us in studio is Jillian Gilchrist, who's Director of Public Policy and Communication at Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I also want to welcome in Claire Capozzi, who's a student and co-president of Women for Change at the University of Hartford. Hi, Claire. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And I want to welcome back to our program Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, who's an education reporter at the Connecticut Mirror, who's been following these issues very, very closely. Jackie, good to see you once again.
Nice to see you, John.
Again, if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We'll be talking a bit about a program happening at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center later on this evening some of our panelists are taking part in. But first, Jillian Gilchrist, let's talk about this issue from the big level and pull out a little bit. We're going to be talking about some of the specific instances that have been grabbing the headlines here in Connecticut. But maybe we can talk about some of the statistics. I mean, how safe are college campuses right now for women?
So not too safe, to be honest. So we know that about 1 in 5, so 25% of students, female students, will be the victim of sexual assault during their college career. And that is for a variety of reasons. I mean, what's happening on college campuses is that you have a lot of young people living alone on their own for the first time, and it creates a climate in which sexual assault can take place. We know through new studies that the offenders on college campuses tend to be repeat offenders. So predators account for 9 out of every 10 rapes, repeat offenders account for 9 out of every 10 rapes. And what's also happening is that we have all, women and men, grown up in a culture where we tend to blame victims. Women grow up learning such things as hold your keys, walk in pairs, cover your drink. And so when a woman is the victim of sexual assault, she herself and the rest of that community, society, looks at her and blames her. You know, why didn't you carry your keys? Why didn't you cover your drink? Instead of looking at the offender and the offender behavior and questioning that.
That blaming the victim mentality, do you suspect that it's worse on college campuses than it is in the society at large?
I think it just manifests itself different because it's such a closed community. But no, I think we have the same problems at the community at large. I think what we do have is an opportunity on college campuses to do something about it. Because when you enter a college community, you're learning about their college norms. You're joining in and supporting teams or have a song, or you're just joining a campus community. And so I think actually we have a great opportunity to really change the culture on campuses.
I think the reason I ask that, though, is one of the things that happens on college campuses that tends to be accepted more than it is in society at large is there seems to be an acceptance of the fact that young people will drink a lot and that young people will have sex with each other. They will hook up. This is something that happens on college campuses. And because of these two things that happen in a different way on campus than in regular society, we feel, there may be different rules at play. Rightly or wrongly, people feel as though there's different rules on college campuses.
So I think you make a great point. What that actually lends itself to is the misconceptions about how sexual assaults actually happen. So alcohol does play a huge part in sexual assaults. However, what we know now from research, in particular from Dr. David Lissack, is that offenders use the fact that a victim may be intoxicated, or they actually try to get the victim intoxicated in order to have to sexually assault her. You know, you don't need a knife or a weapon or a gun because you have alcohol. What then happens, to your point, on college campuses, because there is this accepted norm of drinking heavily and hookup culture, a lot of people assume when we're talking about campus sexual assault that we're actually talking about the fact that, we just went too far and now I regret it. But that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about offenders who are repeat offenders who are using alcohol to sexually assault their victims.
And coming up in just a little bit, we're going to be talking a bit more about how colleges actually deal with some of these issues, including the ways they talk back to women who have alleged assault. And sometimes that is a big part of the problem. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in Claire Capozzi just to get your thoughts as someone on campus right now at the University of Hartford. Do you feel as though the college campus atmosphere is a dangerous one for women? And is there something that we can do, you think, to change that?
I agree with Jillian. I definitely think it's part of the culture, but I don't really think that's specific for college campuses. It looks different, like you mentioned, with alcohol. It's interesting when alcohol is in play because if the rapist is intoxicated, he's less at fault. But if the victim or survivor is intoxicated, she's more at fault. And that's something that we're seeing a lot happening. I don't think there's a really surefire method to stop sexual assault, especially on campus, completely. And I think the way they've been going about it is to completely from the wrong angle.
Wait, from the wrong angle. Tell me how.
It's part of that rape culture, the victim blaming part, you know, like Jillian was mentioning. You know, we turn to the victim and we say, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you, like, pay attention to your drink? Why did you go there in the first place? We never say, like, why did he think it was okay to, you know, have sex with somebody when she was passed out? You know, we're attacking it from, you know, what could the women specifically do to prevent a sexual assault instead of what could everybody do to stop this culture of rape and victim blaming on campus. And that belief, first of all, is really heteronormative, and it excludes men as victims, which happens a lot, and they don't feel like they can come forward on campus specifically. And it also just kind of reinforces this idea that we could stop our own assault, which is not true.
And it has to do with who is being educated, too, on campus. It's, theoretically, these conversations allow us to have this moment in which we can have a larger conversation. But from everything I've understood, Jillian, the way that young men are talked to on campus, the way they are taught about the rules and also what they should be doing is quite a bit different than what young women are being taught.
Correct. And that's what's so exciting about House Bill 5029, which the state legislature is actually going to be – the Higher Education Committee is voting on this morning at 10. What this bill will do is expands on proactive 2012 legislation to include some best practices, including ongoing prevention, education, and awareness for all students and employees, with an emphasis on bystander intervention. We've all probably been hearing that a lot lately, bystander intervention. But what that's trying to do is give both men and women the techniques and the tools to be able to step in. And oftentimes when we say that, people think that means the situation that comes to mind, which it could be, which is you see a guy bringing an intoxicated girl upstairs. How do you step in? But bystander intervention also means giving men and women the tools to step in when there are inappropriate comments being made, such as, you know, hey, I would do her. I mean, that how would you as a man step in to another man and say, you know, hey, like that's not cool, either being direct like that or making a joke. Oh, really? You're not going to get to know her first? Or, you know, so it's giving people the tools to really start to break down the sexism that we have that actually lends itself to sexual assault.
Well, we're going to get to some phone calls in just a moment, but I want to turn to Jacqueline Rabe Thomas to tell us a bit more about this piece of legislation, because I know it's not the only thing that's been going on around this issue at the state capitol this year. But where exactly does this stem from, and what chance does it have?
So I could say that it has a really good chance. It has almost 70 co-sponsors, which is about half of state legislators. So right there, they, I think, have the votes in both chambers already just based on the amount of co-sponsors. There is some substitute language that they're going to be voting on today. I haven't yet seen what it is. There were some initial concerns, not major concerns, from some of the higher ed constituent units to say, you know, if we're a part-time campus, how reasonable is it to have certain staff full-time on campus to accommodate these incidents that might not be happening at the same frequency at a full-time campus where drinking is the norm, where there is a residential life sort of thing. And does it overlap federal policy that is having also requirements? Again, I don't think those were major concerns. I just think it needed to be tweaked a little bit from what the conversations I had with some of the co-chairs of and other leadership on the committee, that it is going to move forward. In addition to that, many campuses are starting to act on their own. Today, the Board of Regents is actually, which it runs the state's largest public college system, they're voting at 10 o'clock this morning also on changing some of their sexual assault response policies to make sure they have things like counselors on staff, requiring that a bill of rights, so say, for students be provided so that when something, God forbid, does happen, they know what services are available, what sort of protection orders, if one's needed, can be put in place, being able to change their classes appropriately so that they don't have to continue to run into an offender while it gets sorted out. So there is sort of action on both sides, on both the legislative side and at the college system.
Is this all stemming, Jackie, this work that's happening up at the Capitol from the complaint that was filed against UConn? I mean, would state legislators really be taking this up if the state's flagship university wasn't facing a federal lawsuit over sexual assault?
Well, to be fair, back in 2012, they did address this. It didn't get as much attention. It didn't have 70 co-sponsors. It kind of went under the radar for a little bit until it became very apparent that, hey, this is something that we need to bolster state laws even more to make sure that the state colleges and private institutions are appropriately responding to this. And it's gained a lot of momentum at the legislature, I think, in part because of what has happened at the University of Connecticut, where a group of students have come forward and said, you know, my case wasn't handled appropriately. And even going to the point earlier about bystander training, bystanders also, one bystander came forward and wrote an opinion piece in the Huffington Post 2 months ago, I think it was, and said, hey, I was told to stay silent when I came forward. So I think there is sort of this acknowledgement from all the parties that changing some state laws isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's not an overreaction.
In just a moment, we're going to get some phone calls here. Let's go to Nanati, I believe it is, in Norwalk. Hi there. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes. Hi. This is Nandini Sharma. My question is really, do we feel there's a connection to the legal drinking age? You know, students are 18 years old when they go to college. Legally, they are not, you know, they're not able to access alcohol. I think we all need to kind of think about when that alcohol does become available in situations where you may have some students who are underage, and then it becomes, and, you know, what's the relationship with that now being available to an individual who is, you know, now legally not supposed to access that in an environment, then becomes inebriated, you know, becomes vulnerable. And, you know, instead of, you know, I completely understand all the after the fact, but what about the before the fact? What is happening in causing this, you know, causing the children, the young people to not have, you know, control over themselves at that point in time?
Well, and right? Thank you very much for your question. And Claire, I'll ask you about that. I mean, we mentioned this already, but how much is drinking a factor?
In sexual assault specifically on campus?
Yes.
It depends on where,
like what's happening at the time. Like, I think we keep talking about how, you know, you're most likely to be assaulted at a party, which might be true, but it might not also be true. You could be completely sober hanging out with somebody that you thought was a friend and be assaulted by them. So I think that's also one of the misconceptions, is people think that you will be assaulted at a party if you are going to be assaulted, which it does happen. I think that, I mean, that's an interesting question about the drinking age. I know that oftentimes with college parties, if you're like underage, if like girls get in for free, but boys have to pay like a cover charge to get into a party, and that usually covers like the cost of alcohol. A lot of these times, like, those kids are underage, and there's a thought, like an expectation, that if you're being invited to this party, you might have to sleep with somebody there or somebody who brought you or something like that, and you might not want to do that. And, you know, you're at this age when you're 18 and you're just in college and drinking is new and exciting, and, you know, you're not really sure, you know, the protocol about how much to drink and, like, what not to do and stuff like that. But I still think that even talking about that just plays into this culture of still blaming the victim, because it still shouldn't be about how much she drank.
No, but it brings us – and before we take a break, Jillian, to sort of an interesting thing that Claire just said. I mean, let's just think about that. Let's just say this out in the air and let it hang there for a second. Girls get in for free and boys have to pay. Now, why is that? I mean, why is that? It's because of all the expectations that you just talked about. It's something that's ingrained, and we're going to be talking about fraternity culture in just a moment here on the program. But it just seems as though, well, we don't want to make it all about drinking and about a hookup culture or about other things that happen. They are real, and they are something that probably needs to foundationally be looked at on college campuses, as we also look at the problem, the prevalence of sexual violence.
Yes, exactly, because alcohol is one tool that is used to sexually assault victims. But because of the culture everyone is growing up in that does see women in one light and men in a different, other tools being used are just strictly the power men have. So an athlete, like we've seen in the news, or the fraternity brother, they know because of their status on campus that if they sexually assault a woman and it's reported, most often they're going to say, it's a he said, she said, she wanted it. And because of their status, not even because of the alcohol, that status alone, and because of the culture we've all grown up in, that woman's going to be looked at again and said, well, what did you do? Why did you go to, you know, why were you hanging out in his room? Even if you've been friends for years or known this person through a class, it's still this culture and society we are living in, which then manifests itself on campus, blames the victim.
We're talking with Jillian Gilchrist, who's Director of Public Policy and Communication at Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services. Also with us is Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, who's an education reporter at the Connecticut Mirror, who's been following these issues closely. Claire Capozzi is a student at the University of Hartford who will be speaking at Salons at Stowe. And that's Crisis on Campus, speaking out to end the violence that's coming up tonight at Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by Caitlin Flanagan. She's a reporter for The Atlantic, who wrote a piece called The Dark Power of Fraternities, just another instance of sexual assault on campus at Wesleyan University, one of the schools that she writes about. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about campus sexual assault. It's an issue that stirred college campuses around the country. In Connecticut, lawmakers are considering a bill that addresses some of the management practices that these schools employ when dealing with issues of assault. Roberta Willis is co-chair of the state's Higher Education Committee, discussing a proposed campus sexual assault bill at the state capitol back in January.
The trauma of sexual assault on the victim really necessitates that they feel the environment is safe, that they are supported, and that their reporting options are clearly presented to them.
We're talking here in studio today with Jacqueline Rabe Thomas from the Connecticut Mirror, Claire Capozzi from the University of Hartford, and Jillian Gilchrist from Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services. For people who maybe just joined our conversation again, at the Capitol, Jacqueline, they're taking up this piece of legislation, and you also say that the Connecticut State University system is voting on this as well. What else has been happening at the state capitol ever since the UConn allegations came out? It seems as though they've been talking about this in public hearings in one way or another for quite some time now, something we don't normally see at the Capitol.
Right, yeah, it has gained a lot of attention. It's also been happening at the U.S. Capitol as well. There was a group of, I think it was 36 or 37 Congress people who signed a letter to the U.S. Department of Education, including Connecticut's two congresswomen, saying we need some transparency in reporting this so students know what kind of campus they're going to, what sort of incidents have been taking place. Now, I say that with the acknowledgement that several people who have testified, several people that I've interviewed have said, just because your numbers might be high as far as reported incidents on your campus doesn't necessarily mean that's a bad thing. It means that students are getting the services that they need. So with that being said, there's also some momentum to make sure that the complaints when like the one that's going on at the University of Connecticut where students are saying it wasn't handled appropriately. Those complaints are private for very good reason so that victims aren't re-victimized by having all their information put out there. But the result of the complaints are very hard to get a copy of or to find out how it your average parent looking making sure that their school that they might be sending their student to is safe. It's really hard to get that information. So there is some momentum to also get that out there.
But that's a very interesting point, though. You know, college campuses, they're very much want to paint themselves in the best possible light academically and as far as their activities and certainly as far as their safety goes. It's important to note that it's not necessarily so that if the numbers are down, that means a safe campus. It may be a place where people are scared to report.
Exactly. There's been some concern around the accuracy in reporting, and that's what the letter from the congresspeople was saying. You know, let's make sure that it's as accurate as possible, and I think that's also part of the reporting in the state legislature's bill is to make sure there's some accuracy and some confidence in what is actually being reported to make sure that not only the services are being provided, that but that people feel comfortable coming forward to get those services.
I want to quickly, Jillian, before we get to some phone calls, talk about this idea of coming forward. One of the controversies that's come up in campuses around the country is that when you report a sexual assault on a college campus, it's not entirely clear to the student to whom they are reporting. If you're in a city, Middletown, Hartford, perhaps you think that you may have your report going directly to the police of that town. Maybe it's just going to campus police. There is a very different trail of questioning, of evidence, of handling the case if it's going through a campus if it's going through a city police department. In some cases, not in all. What can you tell us about that and where you stand on this idea of making sure that when people are reporting an alleged crime that indeed they're being heard as fully as possible by the authorities?
So back to the 2012 legislation that was passed in Connecticut, it was proactive because lawmakers, including Representative Willis, knew that the feds were going to be pushing this Campus Save Act, which would require all institutions of higher education to create policies regarding reporting and available services on campus. So Connecticut is ahead of the game because around the country, campuses don't even have these policies in place, but we do here in Connecticut. This year's bill will expand that to include employees and stalking, which is what's in the Campus Save Act. But what this legislation this year does also, it addresses the point you just brought up, that we heard time and time again, okay, great, you have these policies in place, but for the student, when a student has been sexually assaulted, they're experiencing trauma. Mm-hmm. They're also most likely to disclose to someone they feel comfortable with, which isn't the Title IX coordinator and most certainly not the police. The majority of victims do not report to the police for the very reasons we've been talking about this entire show, that they're oftentimes, not always, judged and questioned by police who might not have training in trauma. So what this bill is trying to do is create victim-centered responses on campuses by giving concise written information to any victim who discloses or reports to anyone on campus. And that might sound, you know, hard to get done, but that is the goal through, again, this bill also asks colleges to teach prevention awareness and a lot of training so that when a victim discloses to their RA or to their friend who then goes to an RA or the Women's Center or to a professor they trust, that everyone on campus eventually will know what the different options are, including, hey, you can go through the disciplinary process. You could go to the police. You can go speak with an advocate. You can not do any of those things but can get your classes changed so you might not have to see him. And So the hope is that we will create campuses that are just more victim-centered.
Let's get to the phones here. Jeff is calling from Prospect. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Just wanted to make two comments. The first one is I think that I don't believe that we should do this, but I think sometimes people believe that the victims must have been doing something to put them in that situation, because if we were to believe that this could happen in any situation, then anybody is vulnerable. So I think that might be the reason behind some of that position. And number two, I wanted to comment on your previous comment about some training, bystander training was mentioned. The Army has adopted a new training program over the last couple of years, but more intensely over the last year, called the SHARP training, the Sexual Harassment and Assault Response Program. And that focuses generally on the bystanders to intervene, to step in, to diffuse a situation before it gets to the point where there could be a sexual assault.
Jeff, thank you very, very much for that. Do you know anything about the military program he's talking about?
Yes, and interestingly, it's been brought up to the point federally. There's also in Connecticut been some roundtable discussions being held by Senator Blumenthal, who was big on a military bill at the federal level. And there's research that shows that actually the campus community is in some ways similar to the military community, because it can foster behaviors that then lead to sexual assault. And so, yes, there have been effective bystander intervention, just as the caller mentioned, at the military. And that's why that's a best practice that we would love to see used on campuses.
Well, one more quick phone call here from Scott, who's calling from a cell phone. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah. What I think is missing in this is what is the percentage of these assaults that occur on Mormon campuses, on Muslim campuses, on Catholic campuses? To me, it's not just a question of what you can do today. It's a question of the values that you inculcate in people. And if you have low values, you're going to get raped. And I think it's a more fundamental problem, and I don't think that laws will solve the problem. I think it's like the Bible says, rend your hearts and not your garments. You know, you're rending your garments when you're doing some of these laws.
Hey, Scott, can I ask you a question? Did you mean to say if you have low morals, you're going to get raped, or did you mean to say if you have low morals, you're going to be a rapist?
More you're going to be a rapist, but the other two.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I'm wondering, do you have a response?
I do. I don't know specifically the statistics of religious campuses. I think it's still all kind of ingrained with the whole, you know, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women and 1 in 6 men will be sexually assaulted on campus. And I... You know, whether you go to a religious college or a private or a public, you're still raised in a patriarchal society. You are still raised in a rape culture. You still go to college with these ingrained beliefs that, you know, women should be protecting their drinks, and that, you know, you are at no fault if you have sex with somebody who is passed out or asleep. And that's just how it is in the culture. So you come to college already with these ideas ingrained in your head. If you ask any middle school girl what to do to prevent being sexually assaulted, they could rattle off like a huge list to you. It doesn't start at college. So it doesn't really matter what college religiously you go to.
And to build on that, men are also being raised in a society where they should want sex all the time, and to think about – are being taught to look at and think about women in certain ways. And so although I disagree with the caller's comment on values and rapists – or being raped, I would say that other discussions that have been happening at the Capitol are starting younger than college. And so how do we possibly start having conversations with young women and young men as early as elementary school in an age-appropriate way, middle school and high school, about respect, healthy relationships, and that sort of thing?
Coming up next, writer Caitlin Flanagan spent a year investigating life within the nation's fraternities, which have become hotspots for crimes like sexual assault and violence. She'll join us to talk about what she found. You can also join us at 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, for centuries, Connecticut's housed one of American journalism's greatest gems, the Hartford Courant. Coming up, we'll revisit our conversation about the history of the Courant as it celebrates 250 years of publication. We'll hear some former and current staff members who will uncover the good and bad moments in the paper's history. You can join us tomorrow here on Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses. It's something, frankly, that we wish we didn't have to talk so much about, but we've held a number of conversations over the course of the last year because it keeps coming back in the news. It seems as though both at the state and at the federal level, people are looking at ways to change this. We're talking with a panel of people who want to change it, certainly. Jillian Gilchrist is here from Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, and Claire Capozzi is here from the University of Hartford. They're both taking part in the Salons at Stowe program that's happening tonight at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford. You can find out more information on their website. Also joining us in studio is Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, who's an education reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. We'll get to some more of your phone calls in a few moments, but I want to welcome in Caitlin Flanagan, who's an author and magazine writer. Her story, The Dark Power of Fraternities, was published in The Atlantic, and it takes a big look at fraternities around the United States, including right here in Connecticut. Caitlin, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Caitlin, before we get into some of what's in your story and some of what you've written about fraternities, you've been listening to some of this conversation. Is there anything in particular that resonates with you right now in this conversation about sexual assault on campus?
The main thing is, you know, you can't help but think of these things on a personal level. And I remember when I went to college 30-something years ago being absolutely outraged when I was told specifically by my university that I should never go alone to a fraternity house, should never go upstairs in one alone or without sober companions because I might get raped there. And I remember thinking, how in the world can I be paying the same tuition as the males at this campus and being told explicitly by my own university that these outfits that they are in league with are places where rape takes place? The thing that has shocked me the most is that one of the few things that has really not changed at all since I went to college is that there's just as much rape and sexual assault at the fraternities as there was when I went to school. But the young women are doubly disadvantaged because now the colleges don't explicitly warn them anymore. Colleges sort of think, oh, it would be terrible if we admitted outright how much rape there is, and people would jump down our throats if we said it in such a matter-of-fact way as we said back in the early 1980s. And so young women are left with both short ends of the stick. On the one hand, just as much rape as there was a generation ago when I went to college, and colleges not willing to be transparent and admit that fact. So I really feel for these young women. They have really been stuck with very little practical, useful help from their colleges and universities. A lot of rhetoric, a lot of blather, a lot of sort of funding things. But when the rubber hits the road, are they really solving the problem? I don't see it happening, and I'm glad there's real traction beginning to take place around this issue.
Now, in your story, The Dark Power of Fraternities, you're writing about more than just sexual assault, although that is, of course, a central theme to your story. First, tell us why you were interested in looking into this culture on campus, the whole fraternity culture.
You know, to be honest, it was that feeling so long ago. I remember walking down, I went to University of Virginia, and I ended up having many wonderful friends who were in the fraternities, and I've learned all of the positive benefits of fraternity membership, of which there are many since reporting this story over the course of a long year. But the fraternity houses at UVA are these giant red brick sort of colonial-style houses that are built in kind of the same style as the rest of the campus. And I remember walking down the sidewalk, looking at this row of houses and thinking, that's a tremendous amount of power and might that resides in these houses. And how am I, as a young female, going to negotiate my way through this university experience when so much of social life resides there? And when I'm being told over and over, and after I'd heard it in many orientation meetings from the university, I'd heard from many a student, including very nice boyfriends I had over the years, who would sit me down and in so many words say, you must promise me that you'll never go upstairs in a fraternity house. And I would say, yeah, I get it, because I really did get it. But that idea of this essential unfairness for female students really stayed with me for a long time. And again, in studying academic life and higher education life, seeing in so many ways that young women have so many opportunities I didn't have and so much freedom that I didn't have, and yet in that one essential area, this area of sexual assault, many of the same problems persist, and I thought it was time for a contemporary look at all that.
A big part of your piece is about the Beta Theta Pi fraternity on the campus of Wesleyan University in Middletown. Maybe you can, just in a quick way, tell us a bit of the story that you found there.
Well, anecdotally, there had been a long history of people saying that the Beta Theta Pi house at Wesleyan was a place where sexual assaults took place. There was a long, bad history between the fraternity and the university because the university wanted their on-campus police force to be able to monitor the fraternity. Fraternity wouldn't allow them to do that. Fraternity became unaffiliated with the campus official programs. And still, Wesleyan young women were going there to party, and bad things were happening. So in 2010, Wesleyan sent a very important email to every student at the university and their parents, stating explicitly, we don't have an affiliation with the fraternity. Don't go there. We can't keep you safe. Well, Beta Theta Pi is a powerful organization. They complained to the university. 37 parents of Beta brothers complained. You've maligned our sons. They're going to be entering the job market. You've made them sound like a bunch of thugs. Retract the statement. Wesleyan didn't retract the statement, but come the next fall when the new freshmen arrived on campus, they didn't warn the freshmen. And it wasn't long before a new freshman young woman went there for a Halloween party and was violently raped. Another young woman was also raped during that same weekend at the same fraternity house. So it's an example of how the fraternities exert a tremendous amount of power over the colleges and universities, and often it's young women who pay the price.
I'm wondering, Jillian, if you can just chime in on this, because it seems as though the fraternity piece of this, and fraternities are not prevalent on every college campus, but on many they are. In some cases, they have off-campus housing. In some cases, it's a central part of, as Caitlin's saying, life on campus. What do you know about the role of fraternities in all this, and is there anything specific, Jillian, that we might want to look at more closely here, especially in Connecticut?
Yes, we do know from research that fraternities, sororities, and athletic clubs have higher incidences of sexual assault. And that's because they are these smaller microcosms where behaviors that lend themselves to sexual assault are allowed to take place. So back to my point before, I mean, I hate to, you know, young men these days, not all, but they do have conversations of, well, how many drinks would it take to get with that girl? Those are some similar, you know, those are actually statements that young men will have with one another. And in a fraternity house, it's more likely that those statements would be seen as jokes and would be tolerated. And if there are five guys having a conversation and they're all laughing at that, but and one of the men in that group is a rapist, he's going to think that everyone thinks the same way he does. We really need men to step in and say, That's not right. You know, we shouldn't talk about women like that. I mean, we're not there yet, and that's why we're talking about bystander intervention. But in fraternities, they tend to be a group of people who are not stopping those types of behaviors.
Jackie Rabe Thomas, I'm wondering if there's been conversation at the state capitol and all of the legislative action around sexual assault on campuses, whether or not fraternities have in any way been a target of any of this.
There's definitely been conversation about having specialized groups, whether it be athletes, whether it be Greek culture, or Greek organizations, rather, have specific policies and additional training for them. I'm not sure where that stands right now. I was just looking at a report or a survey that Jillian's group did back in 2012, I think it was, that had listed how many of the Greek organizations at the various college campuses actually have policies addressing sexual assault, and only two of them reported that there's policies for their Greek organizations on campuses. So I think that says a lot in itself that two of the it was at least two dozen campuses that responded to that. So whether or not they will or will not be required to get additional training by state law, that remains to be seen.
Caitlin, do you get a sense that some of the fraternity culture that you knew as a student, that we certainly see going back to Animal House, and that we certainly still believe is there on campus today, do you get a sense that that's changing in part because some of these external pressures coming from state lawmakers or external pressures just coming from people suing over all of the accidents and rapes and other things that have been happening? Students are ending up dead in hazing incidents. At a certain point, it seems, though, fraternities must need to change after all this.
Fraternities have deep, deep wells of liability coverage. They self-insure. A huge group of them have a vast sum of money called the Fraternity Risk Management Fund. They're very transparent that they're number two, and I published this chart in The Atlantic. Anybody who wants to see it, it's in my article in theatlantic.com. No paywall or anything. We've reproduced a chart from the largest fraternity insurance broker in the country. Their number two most common form of claim is sexual assault. Sexual assault is far above hazing. It is the number two most common form of complaint. So this is something that we all need to look at very carefully. Now, as everyone said, and not putting a moral judgment on either side, the through line in every single one of those claims that I've ever read is alcohol. And Phi Delta Theta is the one national fraternity that as of 2000 is an alcohol-free housing fraternity, and their number of sexual assaults has plummeted. So I would strongly urge, until this problem is solved, until something has really changed at the fraternity house, that young women who want to go to fraternity parties, Phi Delta is a much safer place to go and party. The other speakers are correct on your show. We have no way. They make it very hard for us to find out and to promote to young women accurate information about where assaults are taking place, but we objectively know Phi Delta is safer for young women. So if there's a Phi Delta chapter on your campus, young women, that's a better place, a safer place to party. And parents listening now have daughters at campuses with a Greek life. Pick up the phone and get that information to your daughter. We know this is a fact.
Claire Capozzi, do you have any thoughts about that? It's interesting, the idea that, you know, we're having a conversation here in which safer fraternities actually comes up, not really changing the culture all around, but at least in these little pockets, there may be some safer places. What are your thoughts about what Caitlin just had to say?
I think it's a good idea. I mean, if it's if their rates of sexual assault have gone down and it's alcohol-free, and it's specific within Greek life already, I think that might give the rest of the fraternities kind of the push that they need to kind of follow suit, you know, because more people will be going to their parties or their events and more people will be rushing to pledge and stuff like that. So they'll be getting more attention, and the other fraternities might want that as well and might realize that they have to change their ways in order to get, you know, more people at their events.
What is Greek life like on your campus?
I don't really know much about Greek life on my campus. I'm not a part of Greek life. I had a few friends rush sororities, and I know a few people in fraternities. As far as I know, they have to go through certain training in order to be, like, officially a member of their fraternity or sorority, like Greek 101 or something like that. But I was told anecdotally that the information that they give them about sexual assault is false.
It's false information about sexual assault. Could you give me a little bit more information about that? What do you mean?
I mean, it's very victim blaming that, you know, women have to keep hold of their drinks and stuff like that, and the statistics were inaccurate, and you know, more of the onus was on women to prevent their assaults and not the men, and such like that.
I know, Caitlin, I brought up the idea of hazing as one of the things that fraternities have to take out a lot of liability against, and certainly there have been a lot of incidents about hazing around the nation. As that changes over time, do you think that there's a chance that fraternities then just change more the model of what they're about? A number of times, Jillian has said that it's about the bystanders, it's just about jokes, it's about the culture, it's about how people talk to one another about women when you're in a group of men. Do you think that if, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, if fraternities just grow up a little bit and aren't so much about some of the hazing rituals that have so long been a part of it, that maybe they might have young men in them who wouldn't be so likely to joke about women and then might not be so likely to engage in some of the activities we've been talking about?
Well, you know, my analogy for fraternities is that they are like franchise operations with terrible quality control. You can get a Big Mac in Cleveland, it looks just like a Big Mac in San Diego. But you can go to a chapter of Sigma Chi on one campus, and they are very grown up, and they are running an upstanding program, and there aren't sexual assaults and terrible hazing taking place, and there is leadership around this issue, and there is service around this issue. You can go to Sigma Chi at another campus 15 miles away, and criminal activities up to and absolutely including violent rape of young undergraduate females is going on every single weekend, just about. So it is not so much the idea that the national system can be reformed. It's the idea that chapter by chapter it needs to be reformed. And that's a slow internal job. And that's, again, when you send that daughter off to college, you know there's a Greek life. Don't look up the profile of the nationals. Spend some time online. Look at the school newspaper. Track the different fraternities and try as best you can. And as pathetic advice as this is, we just Cleary reporting won't give us numbers based on fraternities. People will not give us numbers based on fraternities. And the best parents and daughters have is campus by campus tracking the chapters. It's pathetic, and I hate it, but it's truly the best I can offer after a year of a deep dive into this problem.
So it's not that fraternities create rapists. It's that rapists are attracted to fraternities because they know they can get away with the behavior there. And to the point about reporting, what's again exciting about House Bill 5029 is that it has language in there of an annual report back to the legislature on such things as incidences on campus, how many disciplinary proceedings have there been, how many prevention and awareness campaigns have you held. So we're really trying to get to a lot of this information that is lacking.
And I just want to get to one quick phone call. Honor is calling from New Haven. Hi there. Go ahead quickly because we're running low on time.
I'm a clinical social worker in New Haven. I work predominantly with adolescent, boys and girls with problem sexual behavior. And so I just want to add in, and I also played varsity basketball through college, so had some experiences with both associated with people in fraternities, but also kind of what athletic culture is. Two things. One I want to say is one real important thing absolutely has to do with sexism in our culture and the responsibility of men and boys to change that. The other piece, based on some comments, is, you know, the kind of porn, with that, the kind of porn culture that's really been more prevalent. So certainly men and boys are trying to make some positive connections, but the tool set that they have that's also really prevalent in popular culture is these are the acceptable ways of doing it. So, you know, it's not just a, you know, this is a fraternity problem or this is a problem in sports, you know, because the people I work with are not in these kind of organized sports or in fraternities, and it's still a really significant problem. But really looking at what is really both triggering these behaviors, but what's really leading it to result in sexual assault and kind of inappropriate sexual behaviors. So that's my comments for now.
Honor, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. And we've run low on time in our conversation. I do want to thank all of our guests and let people know that both Jillian Gilchrist, who's from Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, and Claire Capozzi from the University of Hartford will both be taking part in an event this afternoon from 5 to 7 at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. So thank you both very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, who's education reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. As always, good to see you, Jackie. Thank you very much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
And thanks to Caitlin Flanagan, who's an author and magazine writer. Her story is called The Dark Power of Fraternities, recently published in The Atlantic. We've got links to it on our website, WNPR.org. Caitlin, thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to our intern, Anna Novak, today. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.